Hello, and a very warm welcome to the fifth in our current series of the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group Research Podcasts. Well, by popular demand from the Parkinson's community, this month we welcome Mr. James Joplin to the pod. Unfortunately, Helga, my partner in crime, is not able to join me today, so it's just me, you, the mic, and a whole lot of questions which I've collated from the Parkinson's community. So as many as you'll know, James joined Parkinson's UK as a Scotland country director just over a year ago, and he's already made quite an impact. I'm sure many of you have already met James, who has been on a crusade really for the last few months, getting out and about and trying to meet as many of the Parkinson's community as possible at local branches and activities which the charity has been organising. So let's get started with the first question then, James. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Super. So you've been with Parkinson's UK for just over a year. So in your opinion, what has been the most exciting highlights that you've noticed or experienced since you've joined the charity?
One of the first things that struck me, and mainly because I met her within the first few weeks of starting, was meeting Joy Milne, who most people might know under the heading of the woman who can smell Parkinson's, which struck me, coming from other medical research charities, as something fairly unlikely. But I met her, chatted to her, and then what struck me is that she was taken seriously, that Thilo Kunath, who I know you've spoken to before, listened to her. Some early findings suggested that actually she did have an ability to spot Parkinson's. And the fact that that's now been taken on into some work that's been led at the University of Manchester into a test that could potentially diagnose Parkinson's in 3 minutes using a simple skin swab, I thought was remarkable. And it showed, I think, which is true in many areas of our research, that things start from people with Parkinson's. And the fact that Joy noticed her husband smelled a bit differently, went to a local group and noticed that everyone else did too, and that that's led to something which may well enable us in the future to diagnose Parkinson's earlier, I think was pretty amazing.
Oh, totally amazing. And it's just amazing. And I think the interest that the charity took up on that and how research has really picked up on what something could have been easily disregarded and now has actually been widely published in international press. It's been amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing that struck me, and having had a career which I've been very fortunate to work for Cancer Research UK, for British Heart Foundation, for charities doing significant amount of medical research, is how exciting the virtual biotech model is. So, you know, what we're doing through our virtual biotech, which has been up and running since 2017, is trying to focus particularly on the drug discovery and drug development end of the spectrum. So you often hear a phrase about from bench to bedside, covering that range of research from that which is done in labs through to things which can benefit people and patients directly. And Virtue Biotech enables Parkinson's UK to work with other funders globally to look at that crucial stage of how we can get new drug discoveries and developments to patients more quickly, funding later stage clinical trials. Also, I think really interestingly and increasingly is looking at repurposing drugs, where we've done the work initially to understand that that drug is safe for patient use, and we can focus again on that speed of progress and speed of understanding of whether that drug can have benefit for people with Parkinson's. And understanding, I think, critically as a charity, that impacting positively on the quality of life for people with Parkinson's is as important as trying to understand those fundamental building blocks of the condition itself.
Absolutely. And I think that's really interesting when you see the profile of the research that's funded by Parkinson's UK. There's a strand aiming towards a cure. There's a strand looking at therapeutics. But equally, you know, the charity's had a huge amount through the physical activity agenda about funding, improving today, improving the lives of people that have Parkinson's or affected by Parkinson's today. And I think to me, that's something that I think is a real positive characteristic of the profile of the charity.
Yeah, and I mean, if we look at a recent example around the stage 3 clinical trial of a drug called Ambroxol, which is fundamentally for treating coughs and sore throats, that there's an understanding now that it boosts a level of an enzyme called GCase, which can help clear away waste products which gather in the brain cells. Now, that's important because our understanding of Parkinson's development is if we can help clear away that waste product in brain cells, we can potentially help slow the progression of the condition. Now, if you start to pair that with the discoveries that maybe Joy Milne has led us to, if we can identify in more people they have Parkinson's at an earlier stage and we can learn about new treatments which will slow progress. If you can slow that progress from an earlier stage, the quality of life for someone with Parkinson's are going to be so much improved. So that's why I think that kind of whole life approach is so critical.
Absolutely. And I think if we could get a reliable way of diagnosing, it also means that people can start helping themselves sooner rather than being diagnosed far later in the condition where perhaps, you know, significant changes have already happened and it's harder to make changes to lifestyles later on in the condition. So, yeah, I definitely see that as a win-win, really.
Yeah, I think, again, reflecting on my kind of first year in post, one of the things that struck me, and be very clear from the next sentence that I'm not a scientist by trade, but brains are really complicated. And compared to, understanding cancer or understanding cardiovascular conditions, yeah, I mean, cancer on the face of it sounds fairly straightforward. At a cellular level, the brakes have been switched off and you've got uncontrolled cell growth. So you think we would have made more progress than we have, although in certain cancers we really are much better at treating than we were in the past. And with heart conditions, you've got a destruction or damage to heart cells, which we know can't replicate. So people then living with heart failure for a protracted period of their life after an incident. With Parkinson's, I mean, I think this is roughly right, we assume that when people are diagnosed, up to 80% of their production of dopamine has already slowed or stopped. So our brains in that time have found all these remarkable workarounds to keep our bodies functioning and working. If you consider it in the context of either a cancer or a cardiovascular condition, if 80% of our another organ had stopped working, I think we'd notice. I think we'd be able to take action before. So it's both remarkable in the progress of the condition that because our brains are so canny at finding workarounds that we don't notice those symptoms till later on, but also provides, you know, incredible opportunities and challenges in how you develop new treatments because of how our brains work and what we need to do in order to try and effect change in something which is so poorly understood still.
Absolutely. And I think it is a challenge, isn't it? Because I think research has answered so many questions in Parkinson's in the last sort of decade. But it's also shown us how varied the condition is. So, you know, different parts of the brain are affected. And I know in the time that I've been working with Parkinson's, it was traditionally just the basal ganglia, whereas now we're aware it's several different parts of the brain, which perhaps explains the variety of symptoms. And so therefore, when we are looking at researching, you know, optimum ways of managing, it's possibly going to be that it's a range of medications or a range of solutions that are going to be required, and personalised medicine rather than perhaps 15, 20 years ago, we were looking for one magic pill that was going to be able to solve that. And I think that makes a challenging area of research.
I think you're absolutely right. And one of the reflections, again, from my experience in other organisations, and I spent a time as the director for Scotland at Breast Cancer Now, is we have a very strong understanding. There are some very strong genetic predictive markers that indicate that you may well develop breast cancer. Those most well known are BRCA1 and BRCA2. Some people might know that Angelina Jolie had a preventative double mastectomy from an understanding of her family history and the incidence of breast cancer amongst her family members. Now, that understanding of a very strong predictor has led to a range of work there, which leads, from memory, scientists to believe that breast cancer may be as much as 30 or 40 different conditions under the same heading. Now, that's brilliant in terms of informing our abilities to drive, as you said, towards personalised medicine, but also it presents some real challenges both for people and for scientists in terms of their narrowing down the field. And if we consider that pharmaceutical companies are driven by profit, and we accept that, that they're going to be looking for drugs that treat the widest possible number of people in order to generate the returns they need from the massive amount of investment they have to put into drug development. If you narrow down increasingly and correctly the number of people who might benefit from a particular treatment or need a particular regime, that number of patients gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And that's where I think charities can provide such an important role by understanding what's needed for people with Parkinson's, filling in the gaps in terms of research funding, looking at those repurposed medicines where, from a pharma perspective, there's less interest because they may already be off patent. So trying to work out for a condition like Parkinson's all those complex elements is a real challenge, I think.
Absolutely. And for those who maybe haven't listened to the previous podcast by Alan Main, really did highlight some of those challenges from his experience of working in the pharmaceutical industry and the challenges of patenting, the challenges of the startup costs associated with drug development are really, 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 really clear. Great. So, James, you have done a fantastic job in the last year visiting various branches throughout Scotland. Your selfies at branches are becoming a legendary thing, itemising and documenting your trips around Scotland, which has been fantastic. I suppose, what are your reflections from going around Scotland? What do you see as some of the things that we're doing well in relation to raising the awareness of research? What do you think some of the challenges are for the charity in Scotland?
One of the things that struck me early on was the importance and number of research interest groups that we have here in Scotland. I think it's 4 of the 12 across the rest of the UK. And again, having worked in other medical charities, I have experienced in other cause areas a real desire to learn and be informed by medicine and research in Scotland by people across a range of conditions. And I think also in Scotland there's a real pride in our history of medical discovery and research, and for a lot of people also a real enthusiasm and a keenness to be part of clinical trials. But I think that is also highly dependent on people knowing who their clinicians are and the importance of roles like people like Carl, who I know you've spoken to already, who have a foot in both camps, where you've got a researcher who also has patients and clinics, because that connection, and with a condition as complex as Parkinson's, understanding what your patients are presenting you with, I think is critical in informing research. And what I've experienced in Scotland is that link is that much closer. Research interest groups working regularly with scientists in Dundee and Edinburgh and the north of Scotland and elsewhere is a critical part of their understanding. And also, I think we can sometimes underestimate the need for enthusiasm and passion that people with Parkinson's bring. And I think as well, it's a nature of the condition, a complex, progressive neurological condition where you're going to be involved and part of that world for a much longer time than you might be with other health conditions. So I think in a way that lends itself to that more mature relationship that I've experienced between research interest groups, between groups and branches and scientists, that it feels much more within Parkinson's, that is it is a meeting of minds, and that there is an equity there of understanding of the importance of the work, which I think is really heartening. And this is not to speak ill of the work at somewhere like British Heart Foundation, which is an enormous institution funding tens of millions of pounds of work. But what I did experience there is the distance between someone with a heart condition and the research that's being done by that organisation, local to them in Scotland, in the UK or the rest of the world, is much bigger. So I think it's a really heartening thing for people with Parkinson's and those close to them in Scotland and the rest of the UK, that research interest groups and branches do offer a way to provide some of that understanding and insight you might want into the condition.
Totally. And I think, you know, the podcasts have really been a hope, a way of trying to disseminate research findings and share research findings to those who do live a little bit more remote and rural, who perhaps don't have the luxury of going to meet the scientists themselves. And some of the success of that is Dr. Angus MacLeod. He's also been on one of our podcasts. He's come back to the North of Scotland Research Interest Group and wanted to run his research ideas past the group in terms of how that might shape the development of a research proposal or shape some of the work that he's doing. So I think that is a really positive aspect of some of the RIGs, that dual role and that ability to involve people from the Parkinson's community right from inception of research right through to potentially being a participant later on down the line.
And one of the things I've also I've experienced, but I think is the case, is that what research interest groups do, which I think is really important, is that following a diagnosis of Parkinson's, and this is stealing something from anyone who knows about Maggie's Cancer Centres and Maggie Keswick-Jenks, but the analogy she used for a cancer diagnosis was like being dropped behind enemy lines without a map. Parkinson's, for me, feels like being dropped behind enemy lines without a map in the dark and spun round 3 times, because it's such a complicated condition with a range of symptoms that are impacting on any one individual at different times. And I think for some people, the idea of maybe going to a group or branch of people with Parkinson's can feel like a huge thing in terms of how ready they might be to consider all of the impacts that the condition might have on them, not just then, but in the future. And I've certainly met people who found a way into the condition and understanding it through research interest groups, that they've wanted to engage maybe intellectually in the condition itself and understand more about what it might mean in the slightly more, headway, and maybe later in the condition, maybe come back round to engaging and spending time with other people with Parkinson's when they've had a chance to really reflect on what it might mean for them. So I think from a general perspective of supporting people with a really complicated condition, the RIGs play a role there. And I think the other thing they do really helpfully is and as someone who stopped learning biology at the age of 13, is a safe place to ask all the really daft questions that you might want to know. Like, I think it maybe took me about 8 years to know that assay was actually just another word for test, but it sounded like great. And then I'd go to talks by cancer scientists, and Miriam, these are scientists at the very basic research end. So the fundamentals of why cells do what they do, generally I would regard myself as being happy with the talk if I stayed aware of what they were saying for about 3 to 5 minutes. The other 40, an absolute mystery. Now that's admirable in a way, because if scientists weren't doing really hard things, I'd be convinced that we should have made more progress more quickly. So understandably, it is a complex thing to get your head around. But I think for the layperson who's just led a life and then is suddenly confronted with a condition that they've never experienced before and might never have met anyone with, I think being able to ask some basic questions about, well, why is it in a clinical trial that some people might get a sugar pill? What is a placebo? How long might this take? Do I have to stop my medication? Do I not? And one of the encouraging things, again, I think to reassure people in Scotland with is two things I've noticed since lockdown. One is scientists themselves are engaging much more collectively and collegiately internationally, because they had to. They couldn't go to conferences, and I was on calls at British Heart Foundation with scientists from around the world sharing ideas, which is always really encouraging. The second is that people themselves and clinical trials have had to be much more accepting, and you know this yourself from your work, about how to engage people who might be in more remote or rural locations, and whether that's a questionnaire or a different way of engaging in the study, and that people in those communities have often had to get used to video conferencing and calling because it's what their life has required of them. So my hope would be for people who are more remotely located in Scotland, there'll be better and easier ways into science than there were before.
Here's hoping, absolutely. So in the time that you've been with us at Parkinson's UK, what have you learned about Parkinson's research, and what's been the most fascinating, and has there been any surprises? Have you identified any challenges other than the remote and rural that you just touched on?
I think what struck me, and this is I knew one person whose partner had been diagnosed with Parkinson's before I applied for the job, and she'd first spotted something was wrong when she realised that she couldn't hear her husband as well, and during lockdown she went to Specsavers, or other audio tests that are available, and had a hearing test, because she was convinced the problem lay with her. And they said, your hearing is absolutely fine. She had also noticed that her husband occasionally was dropping food off his fork, but again, she assumed, it's been lockdown, the two of us have been in on our own, we've just let things slip. We're not dining out, dining as if we were dining out. So it was those two things and another couple of signs of things that weren't quite right that led to his Parkinson's diagnosis and her life turning on its head. And I guess I just didn't understand that range and complexity of symptoms and the importance of the interventions that can be made in someone's life in terms of physical activity, in terms of singing, in terms of drumming, in terms of non-therapeutic interventions that we should be doing more about to support people's lives when they could be managing the condition for 5, 10, 15 or 20 years. And I think the charity is getting better at understanding how to support those kind of interventions and also the research we need to do to evidence them. I mean, I think it's a moot point, particularly if you look at something around physical activity, about how much more do you need to know about the benefits in order to encourage more people to participate. I think there's an intellectual curiosity, absolutely, which I do understand, which would be brilliant, if we could understand that physical activity A was better than B and the level of intensity needed to be A and not B. My question is, do those things necessarily mean that more people will engage, or people with Parkinson's who are already active will stay active for longer? I don't know the answer to that.
That is probably the million-dollar question, isn't it? But I think probably the key thing in relation to that is making sure that the opportunities are there so that people can access that. And I think that's an area that certainly has been enhanced and has been developed, and there's better opportunities both to participate in research but also to get involved in things like singing, physical activity, all those other activities that are so important to give people that feeling that they're part of something, that they don't feel isolated and on their own. And I think the one thing that strikes me is is when you diagnose it, it is a huge challenge to one's identity, changes your life biography, and people have a slightly different journey after they're diagnosed. And I think it's important that there's a range of support that's available, because different people need different things at different times. Just like you were saying, some people like to engage in it intellectually and know everything about their condition to sort of make sense of it. Other people perhaps would rather know not so much about it, but perhaps would be like to engage more socially with others to gain that knowledge. And I think that's something that, you know, it's making sure that there's a sort of range of opportunities that people can access.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I've noticed, and this was brought home to me last week on a visit to a group where somebody said to me that her husband had expressed, when she talked to him about the potential of involving himself in clinical trials, he'd said specifically, "I don't want to be a guinea pig." Now, I absolutely understand why someone with Parkinson's may well feel that changing their medication, being part of a clinical trial, sounds very experimental. And I can understand why someone might be really fearful of that. And I think what I've seen in our groups and branches in terms of general support is the fact that people with Parkinson's step up each and every day and support each other as well as themselves through groups and branches. And RIGS and the rest of the work the charity does is about people with Parkinson's stepping up again and being part of clinical trials to ensure that for a compared to cancer and heart conditions and diabetes, a relatively rare condition, we need a decent percentage of those people to be prepared to and engaging in research in order to make progress, because there are not hundreds of thousands of people from which researchers can pull their people they need from. So I think, again, that's why that educational piece of research interest groups and of our groups and branches and that closeness of relationship with the community of researchers and scientists in Scotland is so critical.
Absolutely. And I know from doing my own research, we did ask participants whether they, you know, how they felt about being randomised to either the intervention arm or the control arm. And it was really quite humbling in those interviews that people said, "I didn't really mind which arm, because actually this is going to benefit the Parkinson's community overall." I suppose, you know, there is that sense of giving back, contributing to the forward steps that research is trying to make. And I think you're right, it's a very motivated, forward-thinking profession. And I think partly we're hoping through these podcasts, it's also just demonstrating that research isn't necessarily always about a blood test. It doesn't necessarily always involve a change in your medication. Some of the results from my own findings are going to impact how we're going to develop those resources to make them better to support the next stage in that trial or implementation within clinical practice. People can guide and shape how research is designed to make sure the resources are appropriate. So people can get involved, everything from the sort of design stage right to potentially being a participant and all stops in between.
Absolutely. And I think what was, again, really refreshing for me and joining this organisation was understanding that the roots of virtual biotech as a model of working came from people with Parkinson themselves. That this charity asked people about what should the priorities be, and that was about drug development and that key stage in getting drugs to patients. We know there are massive international foundations like Michael J. Fox who are putting millions, if not billions of pounds into understanding some of those basic questions that we all want answers to. But I think the fact that we're so closely connected to people with Parkinson's and we can legitimately call it part of a community, I think is incredibly valuable. I think it doesn't prevent us, and nor has it prevented the charity from investigating some of those basic questions. And twice in the last week, I've been asked by family members of someone with Parkinson's about whether the condition is inherited. Now, there's a lot to that question, and I, with my biology starting at 13, know some things to say. But I think when those people asked me that question, it was less from a scientific intellectual curiosity question. It was from a very personal perspective, which is, could I have passed something on to my son or daughter, which has led to this? Now, we need to make sure we're listening to those kind of questions as much as everything else, because for that mum that I was speaking to, I could see how much she was carrying in the sense of, did she hold some responsibility? And as we understand more about whether there is an inheritance factor within Parkinson's and many other conditions, those kind of very personal and human questions are really at the core of what we need to understand.
Oh, absolutely. And I've heard that question being asked many times in terms of people are concerned about the legacy that they leave behind. Absolutely. So from that, what do you sort of see are the challenges or things that we could do better in terms of research engagement, research participation and sort of research activity in Scotland?
Again, before I started, I was at a conference relating to something else, and there was someone from another neurological charity around the table. And I'd shared that I was moving to Parkinson's UK. And she said to me, well, they regard Parkinson's UK as the gold standard in terms of patient engagement, involvement in both the work that we do more broadly as an organisation, but particularly in terms of our research. And the fact that we have lay grant reviewers, the fact that we have patient and public involvement contributors, the fact that we have our take part postcode search on the website, that you can join our research support network. I genuinely, and it's not again to disparage some other major medical research charities that I've worked in, there is a more open and continual dialogue between people with Parkinson's and our senior research community within the organisation at this organisation that I've experienced almost anywhere else. And the fact that there are four RIGs in Scotland of the 12 and that we invest resources of the charity into this work, I think is important. One of the things that struck me, again, over a longer career than I care to remember, is this odd way that as a society we've decided which things we put charitable money into and which things we don't. So we seem to have decided that medical research is substantially supported by charities, that lifeboats are substantially supported by charities, that guide dogs are supported by charities. Maybe if we started out with society, we might have different things. But I think what that means is it's a really important part for members of Parkinson's UK to play, because it is our committees and our experts that we bring in and people with Parkinson's who are directing what work we do, who are informing the decisions we make. It's not government doing it somewhere else. It's this organisation. And, you know, Parkinson's UK is one of, if not the most sizable and significant funder of Parkinson's research in Europe. And, you know, in Scotland alone since 1995, the charity's invested over £7 million in research projects here. That is a substantial amount of money. And there is the opportunity with this organisation for people with Parkinson's through RIGS and those other routes I've mentioned to play a significant, meaningful part in the direction that our research takes.
Well, super. And that leads lovely onto the next question. As always, the questions have been generated for these podcasts by the Parkinson's community. So you've touched on this very briefly, but that one of the questions is, how can we, as in the Parkinson's community, help address some of the research barriers that there is, and how can they get involved in research?
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, there'll be some people who are very challenged by the idea of being part of any kind of clinical or trial at all. But then also I met a radiographer in Dundee a good number of years ago who worked on a breast cancer study. He said, honestly, if I approached one of my patients with a rusty needle and told them it was going to be good for them, they'd say yes. So I think we remember that trust that there is between clinicians and patients, which I think is really important. And I think anyone who's been involved in a clinical trial, whether it's filling in a questionnaire, giving a blood test or something more significant, is to share that story, because I think there's a great reassurance that people who have Parkinson's can provide to each other in terms of, you know, how impactful and what the results of that study were. Also, there is something very positive, I think, in that if you're part of a clinical trial, you're probably going to get more attention and care from clinicians than you might do if you were living when the conditions are not on the trial. So I'm not saying in a mercenary way, just participate for that reason, but you're more likely to receive support and information as part of that trial than you might do otherwise, which, you know, is something to bear in mind. I think as a start point is about joining the research support network, because you'll receive communications about studies that are currently active, is using the hub on our website, putting in your postcode, finding out what's not just near to you, but studies that you can be part of across the rest of the UK, which might not rely on you being geographically present to be part of something. So there are those ways as a start point. And then, as I mentioned, there are opportunities to be lay grant reviewers. You'll be given training and support. And there are people in Scotland who have done that, so they will be given some guidance and support in terms of reviewing grant applications and feeding into the process which leads to decisions being made about what we fund and what we don't. And the thing to remember, I mean, this is true here and in other medical research charities, is what I would say is the reason to give money to a medical research charity to fund research is what you are buying, if you like, is some quality control over where that money is spent. So you are trusting that the charity is bringing together the brightest minds in order to inform the decisions about where limited resources can be spent. We, as many other medical research charities, would love to do more, but we're limited by the money that we raise. But by being a part of these networks, you can help inform those decisions that we're making in this organisation, which is critical in terms of our understanding of the condition, but also the role that people feel they're playing and that they feel they've got some skin in the game.
Absolutely. Okay. So another question's in relation to sort of research funding. I'm very mindful coming off the back of COVID. We're in a sort of cost of living crisis. You know, how is that impacting the charity's funding in relation to sort of research over the next couple of years? And is it going to impact the spend on research? And how many projects in Scotland are currently funded by Parkinson's UK?
Well, in 2022, as a charity UK-wide, we invested nearly £9 million across our research work. So that's the virtual biotech, the research project grants, and the community involvement work. And that covers, at the moment, 37 studies and 12 virtual biotech projects. And bear in mind, those virtual biotech projects are brilliant about bringing in other funders. The pound that we invest in it is often then bringing in funds from other trusts and foundations, not just in the UK, but globally. Now, we can't be blind to the impact that COVID has had, but Parkinson's UK as a charity has come out of that relatively healthily. Again, if I reflect on the experience, and this is public available information, British Heart Foundation, because of its income from charity shops and mass participation events, in the first year of COVID, had to cut in half the amount of investment they were making into new research grants. So that was a £50 to £60 million reduction in the investment in research into cardiovascular conditions. And we can't ignore the fact that the impact of COVID and the priorities that maybe we all had in terms of where we supported charities was drawn very much to the here and now. So your local food bank might be something that you suddenly decided needed support, and it might be that investment in a charity which was doing longer-term medical research might have suffered because, you know, that pound in your pocket has to be spent in some way or another. But we're in a relatively good position financially, so we're not predicting that we're going to have to substantially reduce the amount of money that we invest. And indeed, that nearly 9 million in 2022 was only 6.5 million in 2021, so that was a significant increase. Now, as things stand now, I mean, Julie, you've just come off the back of some funding. We've still got work with Donald Grosset, which is continuing from the largest tracking study of people with Parkinson's over time. We're working closely with the scientists in Edinburgh and Dundee, and we are always, you know, looking for new opportunities and new projects to research. But invariably, as I said, that kind of rubber stamp of quality you get from a charity is that the applications made from scientists and teams in Scotland will stand up against those made from the rest of the UK. And in one point in time, invariably, we're going to make decisions on the quality of those and the money we have available at any point in time.
Absolutely. And, you know, the next round of Parkinson's UK funded grants are due to open to submission in sort of April and May this year. So there'll be some new grants opening for consideration. Wow. I feel we could talk all day, James. This has been a fast half an hour. So maybe we could just finish up by telling me what you think your highlight has been of 2023 and what you're most looking forward to in the rest of this year. And indeed, if there's anything else you wanted to fill us in on. Tough question.
No, I'm pausing because I thought I'll just give it a proper think. I think what this charity does brilliantly, and one of the reasons why I came, is that we work really closely with healthcare professionals to ensure and provide charitable funds to support Parkinson's nurses, clinicians, and other professions that are integral to support people with Parkinson's right now. And that through our groups and branches, we do remarkable work on a daily basis to ensure that the whole lives of people with Parkinson's are supported as best we can. And then there's that critical third part of that pie, which is the investment we make into our research. Now, I think having all of those elements within one organisation is tremendously inspiring for me, because although on the face of it, they may not relate to each other, having them in one organisation means within the charity itself where I work, there is a clear dialogue between those parts of the organisation. The information we get from advisors in Scotland informs policy and campaigns work that we do. the insight we get from healthcare professionals in Scotland tells us the access people are getting to advanced and treatments for complex Parkinson's. And then we can do something about that to try and address the challenges in it that exist. And we know that Scotland, from a healthcare perspective, provides real challenges because it's so flipping big. And if you have Parkinson's and you're in a remote community, quite far from other support, the challenges you're going to face in engaging in research studies or in getting support from a Parkinson's nurse or clinician are going to be much more severe than if you're in Glasgow or Edinburgh. So all of those things play a part. And that critical role that research interest groups play in informing and continuing the dialogue with our scientific community and being able to describe it as such is really exciting, because it makes me feel that not necessarily that we're going to cure Parkinson's tomorrow, but that we can and are cracking some of the tricky questions, and we are making progress through the virtual biotech model in terms of how we might slow the progress of this condition down. And if I link it back to what I said earlier, the fact that I can meet a woman who can smell Parkinson's and that has led to scientific advances in our understanding about early diagnosis in a relatively short period of time, I think is incredibly enthusing when you consider, and I know frustratingly for some people with Parkinson's, what might feel like a, you know, a really slow progress on some of the, you know, do we have a cure or not? We look at other health conditions and we can see the progress that's been made in particular cancer types. There is no one magic pill, and nor will there probably ever be. And as we've said earlier, I don't think there's likely to be any one single solution to Parkinson's as an entire condition. But we are making real progress, and the monies that people raise for the charity are being invested in incredibly important research, which is informed by the people who have the condition itself. And that's what it was when I joined, that's what it is now, and that's the thing that still gets me out of bed and keeps me excited.
Wow, I don't think we can finish that on a better note. What a nice, uplifting end to the podcast that has been. Thank you so much, James, for your time.
Thank you.